Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This lecture series was part of the Marilyn and Siggy Zichrono Livracha Zering, Omer 5779-2019 Pardes program. For more digital content, please visit elmod.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, that's pardes.org.il, for making this class happen. Okay, good morning. Part 5 of Modernity. We finally are going to put Moshe Mendelssohn to rest, which means we can start from there onwards, right? We've got a whole class to do it. Just remembering where we've been, I would say one of the primary themes that I've been developing, at first more heavily, but since then a little bit more subtly, is the breakdown of the rabbinic establishment. Right? The breakdown of the rabbinic establishment as a sociological entity. We spoke about the impact of the Shabtai Tzvi Rebellion. And I just want you to picture what happened the morning after when everybody came to shul and said, "So Rabbi, how about your Messiah now?" Right? We spoke a little bit about the nature of enlightenment in terms of the uncoupling of knowledge and tradition and the loss of power that goes along with, of course, the arbiters of traditional knowledge, as well as the lifting of the horizons of thought, a much broader world. If the rabbis don't understand sort of commerce, navigation, you know, sort of the intercultural aspects of modernity, then they lose status. So that's one side of what we've seen. The other side of what we've seen is the sort of tremendous assault upon a rabbinic authority that's come from the Enlightenment and this notion of dare to know, right? And the increase in knowledge. We didn't speak about the printing press, right? But this increase in knowledge, not just in knowledge, in the idea of reason. Crowning reason king and the perception, rightly or wrongly, that the rabbinic class and the model of religion which they represent is bound up with mythology, superstition, sort of a hidebound adherence to laws which do not meet the rational critique. Things, by the way, of course, which Moses Mendelssohn fought fiercely against. Whatever his reputation becomes later, he, of course, was a great defender of the allegiance to traditional rabbinic faith. He, however, was an opponent of what? Rabbinic authority. And that's where he really tried to dance at two weddings. And we're going to see today that, as the old saying goes, you can't dance at two weddings with one tuchus, right? It doesn't really work. So, what's that?
I haven't tried
and I don't recommend it. You see that I'm limping? It doesn't end well. So, that's kind of the sort of very sort of thumbnail sketch of where we've been. What I want to do today is, first of all, introduce the 19th century as the great age of isms, which it really is, isms, right? So I'll introduce that. I want to sort of finish out the sort of postscript to Mendelssohn's story in framing the Berlin Enlightenment as a movement. And then we need to look at two things which really come into being more or less together, which is scientific Judaism and the reform movement. Because these are really, I mean, there's so much we could do, and I really agonized on trying to pack basically 8 hours worth of material into this one class, and I decided there's only so much we can do. What I want to do, my goal is to end at least with an understanding of how the sociological structure, the groups into which the Jews are broken today, and how we understand our models of identity are really the product of the 19th century. Which is why so many of them are breaking down, because just like everything else of the 19th century, you know, it just simply doesn't work any longer. The 20th century was a good attempt to hold on to the 19th. But the 21st has been a sort of a progressive, pun intended, shucking of the models of identity in society that we inherited from then. All right, you guys ready? Okay, let's go then. First of all, the great age of isms. So we've spoken about Enlightenment rationalism. And I'm not going to go back there except to say that we're going to really return to it because it's what's undergirding scientific Judaism, right? Anything which is scientific, of course, is going to have some rational element. The piece that we didn't really touch on, I'm calling it scientific Judaism because I don't want to mispronounce it more than once. It's a good catchphrase for English speakers. Yes, but it is a Wissenschaft. That's exactly what I'm speaking about. If you don't know what that is, God willing, you will soon. So the next ism that is important to understand is Romanticism. Now, we did touch on this. I particularly brought it up In terms of, at the end of his life, Moses Mendelssohn's great fear was he saw the rational wave of Europe receding. And what he saw rising in its wake was basically what he labeled as paganism, right? In its two forms, either atheism or religious fundamentalism, right? And you know, it's always something to be wary of. Anytime anyone insists on breaking the world into sort of absolute binaries like that, the Jews should be very nervous. Right, you're either a fundamentalist or an atheist, right? Well, how come I don't get to be something else? No, it doesn't work that way. So the fear of romanticism that Mendelssohn had was that it was pulling people toward, well, let's define romanticism as a movement, and I think that might help. And in its essence, it's a shift away from the crowning of reason king and a move toward the emotions and creativity as sort of legitimate and authentic source of experience, right? To be moved deeply is as profound a truth as a philosophical rational analysis can provide, right? So if Descartes, through that tool of Cartesian skepticism, undermined everything to the point where the only thing he was left with was the self which doubted and therefore began with, I think, therefore I am. So the romanticists might actually say, that's on your head. If you get out into the woods and you hear the thundering of the waterfall and you feel the wind in the trees and you are moved by life in your veins, I move, therefore I am, or I am moved, therefore I am. The depth of emotion is very clearly, and in certain cases self-consciously, positioned as a pushing against the cold rationalism. And because of that, it also involves a reach back over to the, back to the medieval era. Remember, the Enlightenment was enamored of the classical era, Greco-Roman, pre-Christian European society, and therefore dismissed the medieval era as medieval, right? Right, whereas the Romantic movement looked back to the medieval era and saw its passion and its mysticism and the sort of dark gods that lurked between the lines of many poems as a source of authentic experience and therefore as a treasure to be brought forward and not rejected. Well, genuine intuition is seen as, if not divine inspiration, the height of human experience. So we call it a gut feeling, and we've learned to be skeptical, perhaps, of our gut. But the Romantics highly valued intuition. Now, there's a lot more we could say about Romanticism, but in the Jewish stories, there are a couple other... I'll give you the sort of classic elements. So there's this emphasis on emotion. Individualism, by the way, becomes extremely important. The heroic character makes a return. Even the heroic character sort of existed in the Enlightenment in terms of the philosopher, right? A lot of the emphasis of Enlightenment discussion was on the discourse on society, right? Rational society. Remember that Mendelssohn saw the solution to humanity's problems as reforming society, right? Whereas Romanticism will bring back the sort of heroism of the individual and the individual's capacity to change society, right? The philosophers were providing systems which would reform society. This will matter for us in a moment. The other thing I would say is that in addition to the just medieval, there's just a sense that ancient custom and sort of folk art, that which comes up from below within society, is of a very precious sort of category. Now, if you know anything about Jewish history, what movement within Jewish history, European Jewish history, have I just characterized? Chassidut, which is why Chassidut lands very squarely within the Romantic movement. It's always a question in world study of world cultures. I mean, the Baal Shem Tov, famous, you know, Israel Baal Shem, who lived, he was probably born around 1700, died around 1760. There's a lot of questions, right? Lived in the Carpathian Mountains, where my family's from. What did he know of the Durmstrang movement in Germany and the rebellion against cold rationalism? And did he actually have any exposure to that? Was there a zeitgeist, a certain feeling of the time that he was channeling? Or is it a natural human response that the more society overloads the mind, the heart eventually will rebel and try to seek parity. We don't have answers to those questions. But in terms of understanding our story, I can't actually discuss Hasidut as a whole, but it's important to me in order to understand where we're going that you should know that there's a whole line which is coming out of that Berlin Enlightenment movement, which is seeking to rationalize and purify, as we'll see later, by stripping away the sort of accretions of history to get to this sort of pure, almost philosophical truth of Judaism. And in the mountains of Eastern Europe, we will see a completely different stream, which is seeking to sort of deepen and intensify its experience of the Torah, right? And in that, whether it's rational that I tie a girdle around my waist when I pray, right? And if you're going to tell me that through your studies, you think that this is a Zoroastrian tradition, which made its way into the Gemara because of the time that the sages spent in Persia, because the Zoroastrians, of course, believed that the organs of the body are separated by the diaphragm, and those from the diaphragm upwards are associated with the good God, your lungs, your heart, your brain, and those from the diaphragm downwards, we'll leave them unnamed, right, are associated with the bad God. That's interesting, but, you know, it's a very powerful experience to tie on a belt which separates sort of the heart from one's nakedness before you pray. So which one is the real source of truth? The depth of experience which is provided by that act? Or the rational analytical perspective of how that act came to be a specific practice? You understand? It's actually, I think, an excellent crystallization of two fundamentally different approaches to truth. Right? So what I will say about Hasidut, because we're not going to tell its story, is there are just a few things you need to understand about it in order to understand the story of the sort of Enlightenment that we're really going to focus on. First of all, we spoke about this notion that Max Weber called disenchantment, which is associated with modernity, right? That the attempt to use the rational mind to shine light and dispel the darkness of medieval thinking also creates a cold bureaucratic culture. Right, one which is sort of like safe and rational, but lacks the mystery and enchantment, which perhaps in a romanticized fashion, modernity looked back on antiquity with a little bit of nostalgia. For instance, where did all the dragons go? Well, it's a good question that every culture throughout all of Europe and most of Asia, you know, things like dragons, elves, magic were taken for granted. Suddenly, at some point in Europe, a bunch of, let's face it, over-intellectualized white men wake up one morning and decide there are no such things. And the rest of us lose out.
They never were, they say.
Right, not only that, even more important. Not only are there none, there never were. And then they begin marshaling all kinds of facts and rational theories of why such things were invented. Basically because humanity is afraid of the dark. And the ultimate dark, of course, being death. Now, by the way, there's a lot of truth that I don't mean to dismiss it, but what Weber points out is that truth comes at a cost. And he calls that cost disenchantment. And he sees disenchantment as one of the great sicknesses of modernity. What's interesting is, of course, that Weber never lived to see the return of paganism in the heart of Europe in the form of Nazi Germany. Right, and if you want to understand Nazi Germany, which we're not going to talk about right now, but I want you to appreciate that you cannot take away people's myths without leaving a vacuum which will be filled. Right, and that's, I'm just going to give you a beautiful quote from Sal Oberon, perhaps the greatest historian of Jewish history, certainly in America, perhaps ever. Right? It's always dangerous to destroy the illusion of a people, he says. It often happens that disillusionment weakens the national force, which was nourished by the untrue conception. Now, he's an intellect, so he's calling it an untrue conception. But what has he just said? That myths play a very important role in evoking life. And if what you want is life, you should be very wary of slaying myths just because they're untrue. What's the value? And now think about modernity and how many lives were lost in the pursuit of truth. How many human beings were sacrificed in the name of humanity? This sort of abstract, which doesn't actually exist, but became a very angry god in the hands of all these isms. Sal Oberon. Salabarin was the professor of Jewish history at Columbia. He actually created, he was the first chair of Jewish history in an American university, and as such really can claim the title as the great founder of Jewish historical studies in the 20th century. I mean, you could look back to Gritz and other people, but they have one foot in the 19th century historians are a different category. But he's got, by the way, excellent, excellent books. He's a wonderful writer as well as a very keen historian. If people want, you can send me an email. I can send you some references. So that being said, the context for the romantic experience that drives Chassidut, which is the foil to the rest of our story, I don't want to get too much into it, is the encounter with modernity once again. Because, you know, Poland is the heartland of Chassidut. And what happens is, just after the Baal Shem Tov leaves the world and hands off to his student, the Magid of Mezricht, who is the one who actually creates a movement. The Baal Shem Tov was an individual who had an influence, he had a small circle. But it's the Magid of Mezricht who really transforms his teachings into a movement. But what matters for us is that Poland gets broken up in the mid-1770s. It might be 1772 to 1774. I can't remember the exact date. And a huge chunk of Jews who were still living in the Middle Ages, essentially, get annexed onto Austria. This is the Galicia that people asked me about before. And there's an encounter between these Jews of essentially still the Middle Ages and what is the burgeoning modernity of Central Europe. And there's a whole deep story there. It's a deep story of a social protest movement, right? Because there was a sense of a great quote here that the rabbis of Central Europe were just another paid official. This may sound familiar, that it was a common saying amongst people that Rabbi is Roshei Tevot, Rasheah B'shochad Yishpotu, right? Rabbi is Reishin, that's like her heads judge according to bribes. Right, that money and power, right, this perception that Chassidut was another deep blow to rabbinic establishment. It eventually will become itself a deep source of orthodoxy and therefore a small c conservative movement. But it begins by dealing yet another fatal blow to the rabbinic establishment within Europe before it, our story is leading, has to basically come in and help save that establishment when it realizes the real cost that modernity offers. So the other piece that I'll add, and then I'm really going to drop it, because this is just the embodiment of romanticism within our story that we can't speak about, but I want you to know it's out there, because you can't really understand the rational reform movement and the Enlightenment without at least knowing it's there. The other piece is this. What was the Baal Shem Tov's great insight that caused Chassidut to sweep Eastern European Jewry in its wake? So great, there's two critical pieces that you named there. One is joy, elevating joy, or I would argue returning joy to its sacred role. And let's not forget when we spoke about Shabtai Tzvi and the possible causes for another movement with which Chassidut will be associated, right? Another movement that swept the Jews in a messianic fervor. One of the things we spoke about was almost the depressed state of the people in the wake of the not only 1,500 years of exile, but particularly the Khmelnytsky massacres in 1648, right? And in the hands of people who don't have rabbinic learning, right? The two principles that the Baal Shem Tov taught over and over again are Malo Kol Haaretz Kvodo, that the whole world is filled with God's glory, Mamish, as the Hasidim would probably add, right? Which means that you don't have to go somewhere specific or even know anything special to encounter God. You just have to be open to the encounter. That the blacksmith repeating psalms while hammering at his anvil could be as close to God as the yeshiva student who was repeating tractates of the Gemara. Now, today, that may sound like, okay, there's just two ways to do it. But I want you to appreciate that in Europe in the 18th century, that was a revolution, which was undermining the intellectual hierarchy on which Judaism was built.
Isn't there a sort of parallel with Protestant?
There are parallels with the sort of anti-clerical elements of Protestantism, for sure, for sure. The other piece in his teachings is Bekol Darchecha De'eu, know God in all your ways. That the purpose of divine service is to cleave to God. And that it can be done in everything one does, not just in nominally religious actions, right? That it's basically a way of walking in the world. Now, why does this matter? Because the reason that Hasidut succeeds where Shabtai Tzvi failed is that the Baal Shem Tov and his students, really, shift the scale of religious experience. Remember that the Baal Shem Tov, Shabtai Tzvi, we spoke about, had built upon, consciously or not, the Arizal's image that humanity can bring redemption. We spoke about this strange notion of completing the Godhead, that all of creation depends on human action, which on one hand is incredibly empowering, the other hand is very dangerous, right? And you get the false Messiah. We spoke about why all these guys began as Sabbatean prophets and then ended as thinking they were the Messiah. Like, why would that happen aside from human psychology? One of the answers is it lies at the core of the redemptive notion of the teaching of the Arizal, that human actions are the necessary ingredient in bringing about cosmic redemption. The Baal Shem Tov shifted what we call Tikkun Olam to Tikkun Hamidot. So the Baal Shem Tov said, you can't be the redeemer of anything except yourself. And that's enough of your task. Right? And that's why Chassidut has this sort of tremendous shift of focus into what we would call human experience. Now, hear the romanticism in there? Right? And think about the ecstatic prayer, all the stories about how the Baal Shem Tov wandered in the woods to learn the deepest Torahs and not in the Beit Midrash. Right? The elevation of the Baal Shem Tov as a romantic hero figure. These all fit within romanticism. And that's not to denigrate them. It's to put them clearly into the story because these are two sides of the human spirit which are going to play themselves out within the Jewish story as well. And just to wrap up, literally, just to wrap up, reason it's important is that for many people, the rationalism of modernity is just too strong a light for them to attach themselves to what was appealing. I mean, it's appealing. Chassidut, if you've never dabbled in it, it's a very appealing. We'll see. We're not going to see it together, but if you continue in this class next semester, or if you want to pick it up on the podcast, you'll see, or if you know already, that many of the strongest, particularly in Eastern Europe, many of the strongest maskilim, Jewish enlighteners, began in Chassidut. They began in Chassidut because it was an anti-clerical rebellion against the power structures and the dry, cold intellectual structure from which they come. They saw these magnetic personalities, right, and were drawn to them. But they realized that if, in the light of modernity, the only way to hold on to mythic consciousness was to sink deeper and deeper into darkness. That's how they often characterize it. The big insult that the Maskilim will hurl at the Chassidim is that they're obscurantists, which is a fun word, right? They gotta fuzz things, right? They can't talk about history. They can't talk about critical analysis of text. They can't talk about any of that stuff. Why? Because to have the intensity of the experience, they must narrow the horizons of thought. It's therefore, I think, rightly labeled as an anti-modern movement. Yes, and those two elements is the experience and the social fabric, which are the two things that modernity took away. Well, I would say that that characterizes disenchantment is, first of all, the loss of the experience of God, and second of all, the fragmentation of the social fabric. Think of anybody here ever read Bowling Alone? Right? That's the sociology of what happens to a late-stage modern society, how everyone is such an individual that we can't even relate to each other anymore. As fighting both those battles. Well, precisely, it's not a mistake that they're Hasidim. No, really. Chabad is the most successful Hasidic movement in the sense that they're still fighting the battle outside of their own circle. For various reasons that lie beyond our discussion, but you're absolutely correct. A lot of it also has to do from the beginning with the way the Alter Rebbe understood the teachings of the Mezrich, of the Magid. Mm-hmm. It's about leading, it's about charisma, it's about being where the people are as opposed to trying to stand above them. It's a lot of things. I knew I was opening a can of worms when I said this, but I want you to just understand that the Romantic movement is not absent. For people who don't know the general Jewish history, I realize that you might walk away from today thinking that the Romantic movement had no expression, no organic expression within Judaism. It's just simply a falsehood. But I also want you to understand, in terms of understanding the arc, is that, so a lot of people will be drawn, and most of Eastern European, my ancestors included, most of Eastern European Jewry will actually stay within Hasidut. But many of the maskilim, the reformers and the intellectuals, will go there. But again, that light of modernity is just too strong to deal with this obscurantist element. The questions don't go away. Once you've started asking the critical questions, they don't go away. You can bury them. You can distract yourself. You can even, by the way, make a rational calculus that they're not the most important thing in the world. But what they don't do is go away. You must deal with them somehow. And many of these young men were unaware of that. And so therefore, Hasidut lost its appeal for them quickly, or often actually just became a straw man that never appealed to them, and they used it as a target. And a lot of the early Maskilic literature, especially in Eastern Europe, is just polemics, bashing Hasidut. But what is interesting is that they're still going to struggle with the cold individualism of modernity. That erosion of the social fabric and the difficulty of relating to their fellow Jew on the intellectual level won't go away. And you know what's going to come out of that, where Romanticism does find its expression even within the Jewish Enlightenment? Two places, socialism and Zionism, right? Both of which are charged with, on one hand, the sort of intellectual structures of the Enlightenment, but also the passions of Romanticism. That's just, we're not going to get there, but I want you to know that that's where, in the end of the day, we'll sweep the cream of the crop of European Jewry into those two movements, most, by the way, into socialism, but a rather important core into Zionism, and I'll leave it to you who won that fight. Okay, that's it about that ism. I'm stopping there. Okay? Right, so we have rationalism, romanticism. We'll sing a niggin at the end. Aviva will help us. No, I'm not doing it. I'm watching the clock. You have to catch me on a Tuesday night tish over the summer if you want to do that. I will do, but only at the right time. So, the last ism that I actually want to mention, and this will be our sort of bridge into the rest of the story for today, is liberalism. You know, today, liberalism is a word that gets thrown around and has lost its meaning. Especially now that the progressive world has begun to try to sort of differentiate itself from liberalism. So I want to say a couple words about classic liberalism and why it matters for understanding the Jewish story at this stage, and you can decide whether it matters for today. So classic liberalism emerged in Europe, you could say, in the wake of the French Revolution, you could say in the wake of the Scottish Enlightenment in particular, you could say in the wake of Napoleon's breakup of most of the political and social structures of Europe, but it's defined by a few things. First of all, the belief in natural law, right? Liberalism is a liberating movement. It's attempting to free the individual from the confines of sort of intellectual, social, and economic forces which kept them back historically. And so therefore, natural law is what replaces any law which is defined by a sort of a pre-existing, divinely ordained notion of right and wrong, right? The classic expression of natural law in Western culture is perhaps best known as, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, right? What's the natural law phrase in there? Self-evident. Now remember that the men that wrote, that's the preamble to the American Declaration of Independence, if you're not familiar, the men that wrote that, most of them were slaveholders, right? Meaning, independence. That's the Constitution? I thought it was independence. Independence, yeah. It's the opening line, sorry. Opening line, fair enough. No, I'll take the correction. 2 points. But it's a fascinating notion that someone could hold the truth to be self-evident and be living in what appears, from our perspective, in deep contradiction with it. Now, I'm not going to go into that analysis, but I want you to understand that this is a hallmark of liberalism. Because it works on natural law, on one hand, it believes there's something immutable, which isn't revealed, but is rather, meaning revealed divinely, but is rather just expressive of creation. But since it's a rational endeavor, it accepts the fact that you may not have the best picture of what creation is. So therefore, that's why, to this day, whatever you think of it, the American Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, which precedes it, are the most successful political experiment that humanity has ever known. Because of the ability to consistently increase the franchise within their society, because remember, when they spoke those words, what they really meant is that all white property-owning men of a certain age are created equal. That's precisely what they meant. And you might they might have hemmed and hawed if you challenged them philosophically, but on a practical political level, that's what they meant. And yet, they create a society which is not beyond imagination that a poor black woman could be president. Right? And that deserves some reflection on the power of natural law.
A couple of the major drafters had professors who were Scottish.
Oh, for sure. For sure, it's a heavy influence there. So that's one piece, natural law, and its attempt, again, to free from the confines of traditional law. Another piece is the utilitarian ethical code. Now there's a problem of language here, that utilitarianism is often seen as like an immoral perspective, right? I had this discussion with a friend of mine recently, that utilitarianism is a moral posture. You may find it personally immoral, but doesn't mean it's not an ethical code. Utilitarianism basically boils down to this idea that the good is defined as the maximum good for the maximum number of people, minus suffering involved. As it sounds, it's almost a mathematical approach. Now, again, the real question there is whose experience counts, right? And you could see much of the liberal perspective on society. That's a social perspective, right? It's not about the individual, it's about society. Much of the history of society, it's two things there. Number one, it really means that it's really the consequences of any action that are the only standard of right and wrong. Right? It means there's no pre-existing moral standard by which you're going to judge an action. All you're going to judge it by is its outcomes. Is there a greater good, right? For instance, right? I bet we could have a hot debate right now that if a person is diagnosed or a person is pregnant and it's discovered that their child has a potentially debilitating disease, right? A utilitarian ethic, which if you've given birth in our fair country here, you know is very strong in the medical community, will tell you to abort that child because it's greater cost in society on the medical system, perhaps on your other children. I don't know if people are familiar with that, but the pressure that women experience in the medical system here to abort when there's any sign of disease in the fetus is enormous because it's a utilitarian in Israel. In Israel, I'm telling you, as a spiritual counselor, I have witnessed things that you do not want to hear, also as a father. But that's a utilitarian ethic, meaning my point is that you don't have to agree with it, but you can't say it's not an ethic. You can say you find it personally immoral, but that's a perspective that you're basically deciding morality according to its outcomes. That's one thing to keep in mind, which leads to the whole perspective of social engineering. Right? That's how you can end up killing so many people in the name of humanity. Because it's true I'm going to kill 10 million people to reorganize the agriculture of the Soviet Union. But what if 100 years from now we have a society in which everyone is fed and clothed and all things are equal? Isn't that worth it? Well, not if you're one of the 10 million. That emerges from a utilitarian ethic, yes. That is one aspect of the utilitarian ethic.
So liberalism is a social construct.
Yes. It's a funny dance. Economically, well, let's put it this way. Once liberalism wins its initial battles of deconstructing the collectivist society that it lives within, then we will start to focus on personal liberty. But in order to get to personal liberty, first of all, you have to fight against all the constructs of society that it found itself in the 19th century. And you have to offer, well, according to this individual and that individual, this one believes what's good is whatever God says. This one believes there's no God. How do we have an ethic that judges within society who gets to do what's right? The answer is utilitarian, because it's a amoral, so to speak, stance. It doesn't have to do with your belief or my belief. That's just calculus, right? It's a scientific approach, but you are entirely correct in realizing it's not particularly in favor of the individual. And it plays, and by the way, I wrote here the next point, which is means that much of history has been a progressive enfranchisement of different parts of humanity whose interests actually even make it into consideration. I mean, you could have a utilitarian ethic within, say, the Western developed world, but let's face it, most of the raw resources we take come at tremendous cost to the developing world. And is there, what's good for you? Like, is it a utilitarian ethic in America? And I'll stop with this. But in America right now, there's a push to provide homeless people with cell phones. Why? Because it actually can help get you into the job market. Because, you know, it's actually, from a certain perspective, it's quite brilliant. But you know that the rare earth metals that go into creating those cell phones are involved with massive environmental destruction and tremendous social oppression in the developing world. So you see the problem? It depends on where you cast the boundaries for utilitarian analysis, and that will teach you much about the 19th and 20th centuries. Right? The last piece in liberalism, and you put your finger exactly on some of the elements of problematic elements, which is, in my humble opinion, why the progressive movement today has emerged out of liberalism, of the dissatisfaction with many of these things. And notice the elevation of suffering and victimhood to an absolute standard in amongst the progressive world. The next piece is economic liberalism. Capitalism is on the horizon. Adam Smith, of course, writes The Wealth of Nations in 1776. It was the same year, wasn't it? Yeah. So the Jews will like that, right? Not being anti-Semitic there, but remember the Jews in Europe have been sort of like preferentially pushed into trade and mercantilist positions, and therefore economic liberalism is going to sort of work quite well, not to mention the fact that even during the mercantile era that precedes capitalism, the Jews have been heavily stacked in the ports and transportation and communication. We mentioned the whole element of that when we talked about the spread of Shabtai Tzvi's notions amongst the converso Hebrews of the Portuguese nation. And last but certainly not least, and this will be our next bridge, is progress. Progress. Progress is the sacred pillar of liberal hope. It is secular messianism 101. The belief that humanity, through technology and the increase of rationalism and freedom, is going somewhere good and that it's a progress which cannot be stopped. It is the defining characteristic, I would argue, of liberalism, that sort of hopefulness. If you know anything about American history, it is the quintessence of American exceptionalism, right? Oh, go west in the whole frontier, et cetera, like to the point where there's a whole theory you can find in 19th century American literature about how rain increases when you plow the ground. It was that profound, this sense that you go there and things get better. And so where does this end for most of the world? At the gates of Auschwitz or over Hiroshima, at the gates of Auschwitz or over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Because the technology and power which had allowed humanity to increase freedom and its control over the world ended that. Meaning Germany, which up until that point was seen as the culturally and technologically most advanced and sophisticated society in the world, did that. Or America took the technological advances of literally 1,500 years of history and used it to kill 100,000 people. Like that, that's what we, you know, and that's why the postmodern era for most people begins then, right? So these are the elements, we're not there yet, but it's important to understand the arc in my eyes. These are the elements of the isms that and within that, we're going to go back to now this power of emancipation, right? Because the Jews up until now have been stuck in their corporate existence within medieval Christian society, and we talked last week about how the Jewish problem is essentially posed by emancipation. Once societies, first France, and then the German states gradually, although there's like sort of stops and starts, and then and Napoleon spreading this idea, sort of throughout Europe in the 19th century, there is a wave of emancipation. And we said that this poses the Jewish problem. The first answer to the Jewish problem in most people's minds was assimilation. That the solution to pollution is dilution. If you just get the Jews to be like everybody else and spread out and stop being so clannish and different, right, then we won't have a Jewish problem. This was the philosophical perspective, was the idea that the Jews are welcome to enter society so long as they check their culture at the door. right? And that was what Mendelssohn was fighting against. He wanted the Jew to be able to enter society as the Jew. At the same time, what else was Mendelssohn fighting against? The internal structures of rabbinic authority. He believed that Judaism should be a conscience, a confession of conscience, right? That a person should recognize on their own that they are bound by the law and practice the law because their rational mind has convinced them that they are obligated. And certainly did not want any rabbinic establishment with the power of excommunication or all the other social tools that are at their disposal in a corporate society which is bounded by law from the outside and social cohesion from the inside can wield. That he wasn't interested in. But what we find is that even in liberal Europe, the Jews just don't fade so quick. They don't go away so quickly. There's a couple reasons for that. Number one, endogamy, which is a fun word that doesn't get used enough. Intra-marriage, as opposed to intermarriage. Even though, nominally, the idea of intermarriage, and there are those within European society who are advocating the full legalization of intermarriage, not forgetting that in Europe, in the beginning of the 19th century, the marriage between a Jew and non-Jew was often invalid under civil law, not to mention church law, right? The distinction between civil law and church law at this point was still pretty vague. I mean, if that sounds surprising to you, remember that America just had a whole legal battle within the last 5 years over the definition of marriage around between two people of the same sex. Meaning the relationship between religion and law when it comes to personal status is a sticky one. And we live here now in a country where it's completely in the hands of religious authorities. And it's 150 years later, 200. So that's number one, because it's, even though there are those who are advocating for that, very few people are actually interested in practicing it. Because for a Jew to intermarry essentially means cutting yourself off from the tribe. Even though nominally these bridges are being built, very few people will intermarry and maintain their status as a Jew. Often they convert. And even if they don't convert, they are shattering all their ties to the previous Jewish community, so functionally they become Christian. Right? This is the world which maybe some of you have experienced, but certainly we've all seen in the movies, of people that sit Shiva when their child marries out. Yeah, because a person was considered to be simply gone. And that's even though legally and culturally the ties are being built. So that's one very strong factor that prevents the Jews from disappearing, because we marry each other. Endogamy. Because, of course, it's not just the Jews that like to marry their own. Endogamy means intra-marriage, as opposed to inter-marriage. It's a heavy tendency to marry amongst your own, which to this day is very common. In America, it's begun to progressively break down. But you know, there's a whole discussion here in the state of Israel. We're very into intermarriage here in the state of Israel between Sephardim and Ashkenazim. Right? I mean, that is also intermarriage because you have two cultures which historically kept very separate. And today, for a shift in values, we see a value in intermarriage. So it's important to remember where we put those boundaries so the words don't have absolute meanings. Great. Another good example. Right? Between so-called Jews of color and Jews of European descent. Right? These are places where we would encourage intermarriage out of some perception of a unity. In Europe at this point, no one has a perceived unity between humanity. Even though those Enlightenment philosophers talk about that, Mendelssohn talked about it, functionally, no one actually wants to live it, or very few people. The other, sort of important piece that keeps the Jews persistent is just economics. Because no matter that sort of this emancipatory wave is progressing through Europe, Jews are just concentrated heavily in financial, if they're rich, in business, or in petty trade if they were less so, because that's historically what was available, right? And with the rise of capitalism will become actually a competitive advantage suddenly in many ways. And nobody is really looking to change. First of all, business is the classic area of nepotism. How do you get into a particular business? Either you're trained by your own family or you have personal connections, right? And some things never change, right? So Jews may buy land when it becomes possible, but nobody really wants to be a peasant, right? It'll take the Zionist movement to have any real serious effort to recreate the Jewish peasant, and they fail. What's happening in various pockets of our country notwithstanding, the vast majority of Jews are and will remain urban and moving toward the sort of intellectual range of economic pursuits. And also, even though, again, the sort of the laws will drop and Jews are allowed to enter into the trades, you still have to find a Christian who's willing to take them on. And the apprenticing in the trades is a very intimate interaction, right, which is, involves oftentimes living in someone's house. Right? Even if you drop the strictures against what you'll eat and what days you'll work, most Christians simply, because the third factor here is just you don't get rid of 1,500 years of antagonism and anathema by changing laws. So between the endogamy, right, the intra-marriage, the reality of the economics and a persistent dislike of the Jews, and by the way, of the non-Jews by the Jews, it means that the Jews will remain a discrete entity within emancipated, enlightened Europe. And that, going forward, not in the story we'll tell today, but I want you to have all the pieces, will give rise to another very important ism. What is it? Anti-Semitism. Right? Because that sort of persistent, identifiable cower... No. Jew hatred has always existed. Anti-Semitism, no, it's important to understand this, and I'm just going to map it out for you guys once again. In the Roman Empire, there was a tribal, perhaps national opposition to the Jews. We were the indigestible element of empire. No matter how many times the empire and its political entity stomped on us, we kept getting up. And we just simply would not accept foreign rule. Remember, the Romans could care less who we worshipped. They could care less what we ate. They might not respect circumcision, but they didn't care what we did in the privacy of our own homes, as we say. What they wanted was that we pay our taxes and accept their rule. And we wouldn't do it. Because remember, the spirit of the Maccabees is that our mission is to have sovereignty over specific geography. That's how we fulfill our theology. Right? And so 1, 2, 3, we never gave up. They just crushed us. Along comes Christianity, absorbs that sense that the Jews are problematic, but transmutes it into the obstinate refuser of salvation. And then the hatred of the Jews moves from the sort of tribal national into the religious. We killed their God. And we spoke about how Augustine creates this model of the suffering remnant, which exists as a witness through time for what happens when you refuse salvation, and also as a testimony to the truth of Christian scripture. Right? That's what European culture inherits, but now Europe is in the process of shedding its Christian roots, right? And to the extent that that's possible. So therefore, as we saw repeatedly, this idea of the barbaric treatment of the Jews is associated with the rejection of Christianity. Like, we don't want to be like them. All the Jews have to do is be like us, and it'll be fine, right? But the Jews aren't going to be like us. You know why? Because they're not like us. Wait, I just gave you three sort of sociological explanations of why they're not like us. I'll leave it to you whether there's an essentialist reason. You understand the difference? I mean, the idea that we insist on marrying each other, that we're concentrated in certain traits that keep us socially together, and that there's a long-standing dislike between Jew and non-Jew are sociological facts. I leave it to you, because we're not discussing it right now, whether there isn't something more essential there as well. But I'm pointing out that anti-Semitism is the rise of new theories of Jewish hatred, which are based in racial and political models. There's racial anti-Semitism and political anti-Semitism that emerge in the 19th century. And you'll notice that they're classic products of enlightenment because they're scientific rational as opposed to religious or tribal. Now, that's what racial theory and the political theories of the Jew are the new form. So we go from indigestible element of empire to obstinate refuser of salvation, to the alien other of society. Right? And there'll be a new phase, by the way, when you get to the postmodern, but you'll have to tune into that some other time. So that's where we are. Nevertheless, despite that grim picture, in liberal Europe, and I'm pointing out to you, notice how liberalism plays directly into that, because it's a rational scientific lens, right? And if the Well, I'll tell you, if the Jews are a problematic element and they're a tiny minority and they're causing lots of friction within the social system from a utilitarian ethic, what do you do with them? One way or the other. If they won't check their culture at the door, then where do they go? Out it. Again, it's not an explicit statement, but it is a strongly implicit one which is built into the logic. Because if there is no external moral reason, hey, we're all human, and humanism and liberalism are not to be confused, They are sort of companions down through time, but they are not the same thing, which is why you can get the libertarian end of liberalism, which often seems to be quite inhuman in its treatment of others. And you can have the humanitarian end, which seems to actually be quite illiberal in certain of its postures. Right? There's a spectrum there. So where does this leave the Jews? Okay, we've got plenty of time. I feel rich. So a couple of incidents in 1806, I think, will serve as a good frame for the emergence of the early reform movement. That's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in understanding the breakdown of sort of traditional Judaism, meaning that which has simply been inherited from the past, into its modern forms. What form will the Jews take in the modern era? And let's remember that one of the hallmarks of the difference between the modern era and everything which preceded it is a sense of self-awareness. Right? Meaning, no Jew in the Middle Ages thought of themselves as essentially taking a different form than those in, let's say, late antiquity. They saw themselves as the direct inheritors. If anything, there was what we call iridata dorot. They were felt themselves to be crumbling, but not of any essentially different form. In the same way, rabbinic literature is a classic. Rabbinic literature, you read it, everybody had a Beit Din. God has a Beit Din. Moshe had a Beit Din. Shmuel had a Beit Din. You know what the only problem with making these assertions is? There's no evidence for it in the Bible, or very scant. So, but why do the sages look into the Bible and they see themselves as exactly the same as their ancestors? Because everybody sees themselves that way, except modernity. Modernity is a fundamental shift to a sense of self-awareness. Of course. Of course they did. Which I happen to believe is true. The question is what you mean when you say that. Right? But that's because I'm the postmodern type. But that's, like I said, discussion for later. So this dawn of self-awareness, in many ways, there are two good markers. They're not the causes, but they're markers for it. In 1806, first of all, 1806, somebody mentioned, I think last week, Napoleon's Grand Sanhedrin. So I'm not going to tell the whole story, but it is true that in between the years 1801 and 1806, Napoleon has his own solution for the Jewish problem. He says, get me all the big Jews, and I'm going to ask them a series of questions. And he does indeed convene what he calls the Grand Sanhedrin. Whether the Jews he gathers are sort of true religious leaders of their community or not is a question of a bit of historical debate. But what matters for us is what emerges, and most of the questions you look at it are questions of where does being a Jew conflict with being a Frenchman? Like, can a Jew do this? Can a Jew participate in the army? Can a Jew pay their taxes? Can a Jew marry a non-Jew? I mean, is there an intrinsic opposition between the sort of political philosophy of the revolution, I almost call it a revolt, the revolution, the universal declaration of the rights of man, and being a Jew? You know what the answer is to most of the rabbis? Yes, but we're not going to tell you that. Right? There's a problem, and it's one that can't be avoided, is that much of the Torah is postured to keep the Jews separate. I had a discussion with one of my children lately about kashrut. You can take anything you want about kashrut. It's wonderful. It's more healthy. It's about conscious eating. It's all true. But you cannot avoid one very simple fact. It is about being different. And that doesn't run well in liberal society, in a society whose whole model, burgeoning, growing model of universalism, is a homogenizing force. That we can all be together if we're all the same. It's a perception that it's difference which prevents us from being together. And so therefore, one of the great forces of modern universalism is homogenization. We've already seen it. The Jew can check their culture at the door. Notice, there's a majority assumption, meaning homogenization doesn't mean the Christians are going to become more like the Jews. That's what we call a normative assumption. It's a normative, and we spoke about that a little bit with Lavater's attempt to convert Moses Mendelssohn. So one hand, this Grand Sanhedrin declared Jews no longer tolerated aliens, but rather Frenchmen of Mosaic faith. And this is what I want you to take away from this beginning of the 19th century. Napoleon's Sanhedrin is probably the most classic example of it, but it's happening everywhere throughout the emancipated world. This idea of the reduction of Judaism to a confession, to a faith, to what we call a religion. Now you might think, wait a minute, hasn't it always been a religion? I would say no, not in the sense that modernity considers a religion. Remember, we spoke about the Treaty of Westphalia and this emergence of a political structure which was larger than religion. And the at least creating of an infrastructure for a secular society that where you could have a state whose relationship to the individual transcended their religion. You could have a state where you would have both Protestants and Catholics who would both be citizens, which was a huge chiddush for Europe. Notice I didn't say Jews, because in 1648, the Jews weren't citizens. But that set the stage for the notion that the state relates to the individual regardless of their religion, which means that their religion must be subservient to the state, do you understand? And that's where the Jews are a problem, because the Jews insist on being essentially a nation within a nation. So what Napoleon says, if you want to be free, you must give up on the national or communal tribal elements. And I'm not telling you have to become a Christian, but I am telling you have to be a Frenchman of Mosaic persuasion. Now, what's interesting is that, as we'll see, Orthodoxy is more than happy to take this stance as well. So long as the state is willing to respect the boundaries of very specific religious behaviors, they don't make us eat their food, they'll respect the fact that we don't fight war on Saturday, you know, et cetera. So then we will see strongly, not in our story now, but you will see if you look into the 19th century, the strong emergence of what we would call deeply assimilated, faithful Orthodox Jews. They're deeply assimilated from a national perspective. They are Germans, Frenchmen, Hungarians, from. They wouldn't eat my house, but they're still Germans, Frenchmen, and Hungarians. You understand? And that distinction, which involves the reduction of Judaism to a pure, what we call a confession of faith, that's the European term, just like Christians can be Frenchmen, Germans, and Hungarians, so can Jews, right, really has its inflection point at Napoleon's Sanhedrin. And that's going to be one of the characteristics of the coming story. The other one also happens, interestingly enough, in 1806. There's a journal based in Kassel called Shulamit. And it publishes an anonymous article that offers, for the first time that we know in print, a revolutionary reformation of a very old statement of Shmuel from the Haradiyah, right? Shmuel, of course, was the older foil of Rav in the Gemara. And there's a machloket in the Gemara about what the Messianic era is. I don't know about you guys, but let it be soon, let it be now. It's a very important part of my life, this idea of the Messiah. And if you look through Jewish history, the Messiah is not just a sidelight. It's not just like one of the 13 articles of faith. It's not just like the spice to the meal of Judaism. It's an essential posture in the world, right? Which means that the world is not yet. The world is not yet, and that we as a people hold a very special role in bringing the world to what it could be. Now, it's true that that operates on any number of planes. Cosmic, remember the Arizal. National historic, right? That's like we're going to go back to our land physically and rebuild the temple. And then the Baal Shem Tov points out that your own redeemed state is a critical ingredient in that, right? So the Messianic frame is not a sidelight of Jewish thought. So there's an argument in the Gemara between Shmuel and Rav Chisda. They didn't actually argue one with the other. The Gemara puts them together. About what the Messianic era is. I mean, if you look up in the book of Isaiah, for instance, and the lion laying down with the lamb and the child playing with the viper, etc., it looks like a fundamental change to nature. And that's the posture that Rav Chisda takes, right? Basically, it's a evolution or revolution of being. Shmuel says something fundamentally different, though. He says, "Ein ben yemot ela yemot Mashiach." There's no difference between the world in which we live and the redeemed messianic world other than our subjugation to the nations. It's a sociopolitical. The Rambam is probably the most famous Rishon who picks this up. And the Rambam paints a picture, we'll call it a restorationist picture, as Professor Gershom Shalom calls it, of the Messianic era. Messianic era means sovereignty, the temple, Jews are from. It doesn't mean any difference. Or as Reb Shlomo used to say, that it's not like when you get on the bus, you won't have to pay. It's just that if you don't have any money, the guy behind you will pay for you. Right? It's not a fundamental change in the world. Now, here's what's interesting. That sounds very nice and hopeful and much more rational. Right? So this article in Shulamit says, well, if that's the case, well, then I'll tell you what. Emancipation is redemption. Because if there's no difference between the world in which we live and the world of the Messiah, other than our subjugation to the nations, then we're no longer subjugated. The nations have set us free within their boundaries. Now, we used to think in our medieval notion the only way we would ever be free was be sovereign in our own land. Fine, we were wrong. We're Frenchmen of a Mosaic persuasion now. The subjugation of the nations is gone, which means that modernity is the Messianic era. You understand? And it also means that Judaism has gone from being a national existence to an individualistic universal one. You understand the linked individualistic universal? Meaning that I can fulfill the Messianic era by myself, by being a liberated Frenchman. Now, it doesn't say anything about my attachment to the law. I mean, I can also, I'm not eating shrimp, and I don't fight war on Saturday, and all that good stuff, right? But I stand when they play the French national anthem, the Marseillaise, right? Yeah. Oh, I'm impressed. You see the power. First of all, it's a very powerful presentation of an idea. It's also a fundamental shift in Jewish thought. Everybody up till now, people that gave up, but everybody who's still holding out for the Messiah still thinks of it in those mythic terms of we're gonna go home. Maybe rebuild the temple, and then it's a restorationist, even if it's the Rav Chisda version of restorationist, and then, you know, loaves of bread will grow from the trees, and you know, lions will eat straw, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's still a fundamental shift, whereas well, this is an assertion that modernity, that here the secular progress hope, that, like, we have achieved the Messiah. Yeah. Shmuel would never argue with that, but his statement when he said it is there's no difference between that and except, you know, between exile and redemption other than the subjugation of the nations. It's clear from the context he's thinking of sovereignty and national rest, but it doesn't actually say that.
The only problem with that definition is
it only lasted for about 50 years. Well, fine, but they don't know that.
But they don't know it yet because they don't need it.
I'm not advocating, I'm just pointing out to you. Listen, I'm just pointing out to you that I want you to appreciate that what comes next, which is the birth of the Reform movement and scientific Judaism, is not, and this is, maybe you guys don't suffer from this problem, but often when I teach in sort of like the more traditional side of the settings that I teach in, there's just an assumption that the Reform emerges out of desire, just like, for Zionist, it's hard to be a Jew, I want an easier life, and like, I don't want to be a guy, so I'll just do the halfway thing, right? Which may be true for many people, but I want you to appreciate there's a profound, what? Well, but that, listen, I'm making a distinction the same way I was making for Dove. I want you to understand where these things come from. You are correct that you also know a thing by where it ends up, but you can't know one without the other. So these two, this sort of combined together for opening the door for a true sort of like loss of peoplehood and a full embrace of modernity in the, I'll say, reduction of Judaism into a confession. Into a confession which might be totally bound to the law right now. No one has said anything about the law yet. So one of the great personalities that stands as a precursor to the Reform movement is Israel Jacobson. Israel Jacobson was a German Jewish philanthropist, communal organizer. You know, I realize I skipped the Berlin Enlightenment in my excitement. That's fine. We spoke a little bit about it. He's a product of the Berlin Enlightenment. He's Israel Jacobson. He's born in 1768, dies in 1828. He's Jewish one. Yeah, I realize I actually. Yeah, there's both. And I realize in my notes here I jumped over it, which I think for the flow of the story is fine. Just suffice it to say that there was an intellectual movement which emerged out of Mendelssohn's personality. And the focus of that movement was on education. As we saw actually a little bit in Divrei Emet v'Shalom, if you remember Wellesley and the whole storm that erupted at the end of Mendelssohn's life, the focus was on education because either from the utilitarian standpoint, we want to get Jews into society, so we have to get the skill set and the language set, etc. Or from the cultural standpoint, which is we also want to break down the power of rabbinic authority and open the Jewish community to the light of the Enlightenment. The key is education, which of course is a classic liberal modern stance, that education is the key to everything, which I still agree is true. So he is in many ways a product of that Berlin Enlightenment. He attended the Jewish religious school in his leisure hours, studying German literature and Moses Mendelssohn, according to his own account. He developed somewhere along the way a belief in an egalitarian, what we call religious pluralism in education. Right? And so he builds a school in the Harz Mountains, a very wealthy man. Builds a school in which 40 children of Jewish parents and 20 children of Christian parents will be educated together. Everyone will get free board and lodging. He's backing it with his own money. And it's an experiment in education. It's another one of these sort of very classic modern liberal notions of like education. Okay, I'll build the school. I'll make it, you know, it's a fascinating, I mean, some of them failed, some of them succeeded. But he builds a school in Seesen. It's the name of the town. And it goes about its business. But then in 1810, he adds to the school what he calls a temple. And this temple, it's the Jewish prayer service, but the hymns are suddenly have been translated into German. He adds a choir to sing them. And the prayers are translated, some of them, into German. And he adds a pipe organ, which at that point was not so clear one could play on Shabbat. There's a whole polemic around the pipe organ. I'm not going into it. I don't know how many of you grew up in a shul with an organ and a choir, but I was in the boys' choir when I was growing up. Now, this is all well and good in this little school up in the mountains. Nobody really cared or, frankly, knew. But it is important to remember at this point in history that the Jewish community within the German states, and particularly in Prussia, where he was, is organized into official government-recognized bodies and has been so for centuries. I believe it actually still is, if I'm not mistaken. And these were these sort of like semi-autonomous bodies that Moses Mendelssohn had made the target of many polemics, asking the rabbis to dissolve them voluntarily. Remember we said he was fighting a two-front battle, toward larger Christian society to accept the Jew into without preconditions, and internally within Jewish society to get the rabbis to basically put down the sword and pick up the Torah again, as he would put it, right? To basically cease to be authority figures and return to being educators. And so when these organizations are still alive and well, in many ways they've actually been strengthened, although constrained. Because as we talk about this momentum of enlightened absolutism and the concentration of power in the state, anything that we would call civil law has essentially been taken away from these courts. People aren't able to adjudicate their monetary issues in the religious courts anymore, except in what we would call arbitration courts, meaning you can always get a rabbi to adjudicate your monetary issues if your business partner just go to the rabbi. It's okay, and if you agree, divide by this decision. But it doesn't have the force of communal law any longer. But the one place that the state has allowed the Jews to reign supreme is, you guessed it, in shul. And if you want to understand a lot of the sort of emergence of the movements within European, Central European in particular, history, and the sort of like vitriol, like the anger. Everybody ever been in shul? And seeing grown men shouting at each other over what seemed to be hair-splitting distinctions in ritual law? I don't know if you've ever seen that. I've been verbally assaulted at the Almud more than once. Ever wonder, where does all that angst come from? Well, part of it is just testosterone, let's face it, right? But part of it, there's a very long backstory to the reduction of sovereignty into the Beit Knesset. Right, that particularly in the German states, that the what had been a national existence had been progressively reduced to the space of the synagogue, and so therefore, when that became a contested space, oy vey, it's gonna explode, and that's exactly what happens. That Jacobson eventually moves to Berlin. He had a certain position under Napoleon. Actually, we're going to just skip that part of the story. It's not so important. He moves to Berlin, and he starts a private community, not trying to intervene into the public sphere there, where he brings this mode of worship that he calls a reformed, small r, mode of worship into Berlin. And the first shot fired in the contest is the Rebbe Akiva Eger of Posen. If you're familiar with Rebbe Akiva Eger, very important, perhaps the greatest rabbinic authority of his day, although his son-in-law the Chatam Sofer sort of like eclipses him even in his own lifetime. He publishes a short rebuke of this habit. What's important is it's not a rebuke specifically on you can't play an organ on Shabbat, or you know, it is a rebuke under the general category of Chukot Hagoyim, right? That basically you're doing like the Gentiles do, which is a din d'rabbanan, perhaps could even be a Torah level prohibition, depending on how you slice it. There certainly are verses of the Torah that underpin it. But you understand that aside from the internal Jewish discourse, what's really happening here is a reaction to modernity. That all the momentum I just described to you is the Jews becoming more like the non-Jews. And the only question is, will we be able to maintain our status as Jews when we do it? I mean, Mendelssohn says, yes, accept us into your society as Jews. But as we pointed out, the bulk of his children convert to Christianity after he dies. So there's a question if that worked. Then you have the Berlin Enlightenment, which was less wedded to traditionalism and more interested in Enlightenment culture, and therefore was pushing Reform Jewish education, right? Which was avowedly based on liberal European models, certainly in German language. Germany was considered the point to be the height of culture, right? And here you now have the beginnings of the inroads on ritual, that we're going to do the hymns in German, we're going to have a choir and a pipe organ like they have in church. That's where they get it from. We're going to wear the fancy robes, right? We're going to start to use the terminology of minister and pastor, etc., right? And so, therefore, the first shot fired was on Chukot HaGoyim. But the real controversy doesn't actually happen in Berlin. It happens in Hamburg, when the New Israelite Temple Society is founded in December of 1817. And it's within the year that the controversy erupts here. Because not only do they take all of Israel Jacobson's reformed sort of modes of worship, but for the first time, a reformed liturgy is published. And it's not what it says, actually, that matters. It's what it doesn't, right? Because they excise the sacrifices, references to the return to Zion, and the rebuilding of the temple, right? Oh, the resurrection of the dead. The resurrection of the dead might not have been missing from the first version. I think that comes in the second round under Geiger. So either way, it's not a critical distinction for right now. The key is that you now have a critical historical view of text and therefore peoplehood, meaning that the Siddur is not just a sacred inviolate text which we've inherited from the past, which indicates what our future will be. The Siddur is now seen as an ongoing project which should reflect the views of the people who are praying from it today. And you know what? It's a big hit. It's a big hit. Because for all the furor that erupts around it, the reports that are on the first Yom Kippur after the inauguration of this temple, there was a lack of seating. There were so many people that wanted to be there. And there were many people who attested to the fact that they hadn't fasted for years, and they decided to do so then. Meaning, nothing sells like success. Right? And so there's a tremendous question which is posed here. But I want you to appreciate, what do they call it? They call it a temple. They call it a temple because the Mikdash Me'at, the little sanctuary, which is what the rabbinic terms for the synagogue was, has now truly replaced in their eyes the temple in Jerusalem. Because why? Because they are potentially living in the Messianic era in an emancipated European society. And therefore, there is nowhere else to go to. They have achieved redemption as Frenchmen, or Germans in this case, of the Mosaic persuasion. And eventually, of course, it's not just a cliche. They do come to call Berlin the New Jerusalem. And now you can understand in a little bit of a more of a historical continuity sense how such a thing could come to be. Now, I only have about 15 minutes left, and I really want to present the pieces in a proper fashion, so I'm going to start to talk faster, okay? One can really make an argument. By the way, if you think that the reaction to Israel Jacobson's project was a little bit fierce, it doesn't hold a candle to the reaction of the rabbinic establishment. By 1819, once word of the Hamburg Temple gets out and a version of this liturgy is seen by the rabbinic establishment, particularly the Chatam Sofer, who was the leader of Hungarian Jewry in his day, Hungarian and a lot of German Jewry, the son-in-law of Rabbi Akiva Eger. There's polemics. Letters are written, tshuvot, responsa. I'm not going to give you the details. What I want you to understand is that in many ways, this marks the birth of both the Reform and the Orthodox world. Why? Reform, we understand why. Because we'll speak a little bit about scientific Judaism and the tools that are fueling this mindset momentarily, right? But it is a historically self-conscious movement. There's a desire to use the tools of philology, the study of text through time, of comparative analysis of text and religion, of historical critical perspective. How do peoples develop over time? There's a desire to use those tools to strip away what is perceived as historical accretions and distortions in order to produce the pristine Judaism which is befitting of a modern people. Right? That is the project. Right? And you can see how it is a deliberately self-aware historical process. Yeah, you with me on that? So Orthodoxy is born in its struggle against that. And that makes Orthodoxy just as much a modern movement as Reform. It's very important, in my opinion, if you want to understand the world today, the Jewish world, to understand that. Orthodoxy is not a traditional movement. It is a traditionalist movement, and that makes all the difference. A traditional movement is an organic product of its past, right? And because of that, rarely has the self-awareness to ask, wait a minute, is this how we've always done it? Because it has evolved, I would argue, evolved. We can take an ahistorical view and say it's never evolved. It doesn't really matter. Its self-perception is that right now, have you ever seen, I'll give you the example. Have you ever seen the bencher that shows Moses wearing a strimal, carrying a Torah out through Red Sea? I never know which one's crazier, the strimal or the Torah. Remember, of course, you have the Torah at the Red Sea, right? He's a perfect expression, meaning, of course Moses looked just like me. Who else would he look like? And we mock now, but you understand that that is the hallmark of the traditional element. It's unself-aware. Because of that, ironically, is much more capable of adapting. Because human psychology is tremendous. Even in the midst of the most profound traumatic changes, human psychology militates in favor of believing that everything now is as it's always been. That's one of our deepest needs. And so therefore, traditional societies are able to actually incorporate, I mean, I'll give to you, were the rabbis of Yavne traditionalists or traditional? I mean, they lived through the most profound change that Am Yisrael has ever seen, at least until 1948, right? And so therefore, in many ways, they belong to both. It depends on how you read the Midrashim and the Gemara around it. But what happens in the early 20th century, early 19th, sorry, is that the leaders of Orthodoxy are well aware of the threats of modernity. They're well aware of what's going on, and now they have to take a self-conscious stance against the fact that there is another way to be a Jew. That's the other way to put it. The traditional attitude is, well, you mean I'm a Jew. Like, what? Oh, yeah, so those guys, they're fried now. They're not from anymore. But they're not offering another way of being a Jew, because there's only one way of being a Jew. It's the way we've always been. That's traditional. But now you have these guys saying, no, there are other ways, better ways, more enlightened, modern ways of being a Jew. It's very important. They're trying to find the way in which Judaism will embody itself in modernity. And now the traditional people have to become traditionalists. We're militating in favor of the way it's always been, which is why the Chatam Sofer actually gives the greatest innovation in Jewish history. You know what it is? Ein chadash min haTorah. There is nothing new in the Torah, which is the greatest innovation of thought of Jewish history. The idea that nothing changes is one of the biggest changes that Judaism sees in the 19th century. And that is the classic traditionalist stance. It's absurd that nothing changes. It's an absurd notion. Everything changes. The question is, are you aware of it or not? And this is what I said. This is the hallmark of modernity, is that process of self-awareness. And therefore, even Orthodoxy, which claims authenticity and the tradition from Sinai, it must respond by self-consciously claiming that it never changes. You guys know the joke, right? How many Orthodox rabbis does it take to change a light bulb? Change. We don't change. Right? I am an Orthodox rabbi, just for the record. And I do change the light bulbs in my house. So this really erupts around the Hamburg Temple. But I want to get a little bit of the backstory in the remaining minutes we have. Because, you know, one of the early members of the Berlin community, and then he was almost an observer, I would say, of the Hamburg controversy, is a young man named Yom Tov Lipman Zuntz, also known as Leopold. Leopold Zuntz is another one of these products of educational reform. He grows up, he's the son of a Talmud scholar in Westphalia, Germany. He's born in 1794, but by 1815, he's got a doctorate from the University of Berlin. He also gets ordination, smicha, from Aaron Charan, who's a well-known sort of early advocate, Hungarian rabbi, advocate of reform. So he comes from both worlds. He has, to some degree, I mean, he's quite a religious background and gets smicha on some level. He's certainly not uneducated, but he's got a PhD from the University of Berlin. And his opening salvo in what becomes really an intellectual revolution is an essay called On Rabbinic Literature that he publishes in 1818, same year that the Hamburg controversy erupts. And beyond the immediate field of study, which he basically births, he births a academic approach to rabbinic literature. Just think about it. It's a crazy notion. I mean, he has access to the entire Beit Midrash, printed, handwritten. I mean, Jews don't throw things out. I mean, ultimately, Salman Schachter will go to the Gniza in Cairo, and you'll suddenly have 1,500 years of text through time. This is inconceivable to the average researcher in philology and the change of language through time to have that kind of wealth. It's like, who has that? The Jews have had it forever, says Zuntz, and we're not doing anything with it. It's insane, he says. We're sitting here in our self-referential world, learning our texts and never understanding them. Anyway, he is the beginning of a birthing of a historical consciousness. We'll call it a coming to consciousness within Am Yisrael. And I only have a few minutes, so I think I'm going to end on this. Leopold Zuntz, Z-U-N-Z. See, pull back the lens for a second. I'm going to tell you a story that I think will draw this together. So what's happening is that Am Yisrael in Europe is seeking a way to embody itself in modernity. Right? So because this option of absorption is not working. Right? We talked about it. It's the Jewish problem. Even though there will be plenty of people, because most people don't have the intellectual capacity or even the concern to focus on how am I going to be a Jew in the new world. Many people just fade away into assimilation or conversion. Nevertheless, there's a core, the majority core of Jews that want to remain Jews or, as we spoke about, don't have a choice. They're forced to. But how are they going to be Jews in the modern world? And what you're getting is a split. Those who choose the tools of modernity to reform what was in a self-conscious manner, and those who choose a reaction to modernity in an attempt to hold on to their notion of, let's call it, what should have been, which is not the same as what was. That's the difference between traditional and traditionalist. And that's not to disparage. I'm a big fan. We can talk about it if you want later. But I want you to understand the posture of conflict. And the issue on which they fragment is historical consciousness. Which is, I think, a good place as any to end our story. What does it mean to come to historical consciousness? What was Leopold Zuntz adding to the conversation that really, ultimately, his intellectual heir is Avram Geiger, Rabbi Avram Geiger, who's really honestly pinpointed as the founder of the Reform movement. But it's Zuntz that really founds what he calls the science of Judaism, Wissenschaft der Judentum, Judentum, right? A science of Judaism. What is he trying to do, and why does it have such a profound impact? Well, you know, coming to historical consciousness is basically, in his eyes, a re-engagement of the depth of the Jewish story. In order to engage the depth of a story, you have to step out of it. You have to realize that you're in a story, but then you have to step back in. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to get a critical perspective on all of rabbinic literature in order to understand what were the sages actually doing in order that we can understand what it is they're asking of us today. Now, here's the challenge. You know, that's what we call in traditional language, dat chitzoni. It's an external consciousness. And it has its roots in the whole argument that comes down through the ages on what's called Chochmat Yavan, Greek wisdom. Is it permissible to learn Greek wisdom? I want to, for the last 5 minutes, take you back, those of you guys that have been together for the year, to the Hasmonean period. I don't even know if that was this year. It might have been last year. The Hasmonean period ends in a civil war. And the Gemara tells the story, Gemara Novo Zahar tells the story that there are two brothers, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, are fighting each other, the last two Hasmoneans. One's inside the walls of Jerusalem, one's outside. And they're fighting, and nobody can get the better of the other. And every day, because they're also priests, right? They're not just Hasmonean kings. Every day, the people inside lower a basket down the wall with full of gold coins. And the people outside the wall who are fighting them take the coins and put a goat, two goats, actually, in the basket that they can pull it back up. For what? The daily sacrifice. This goes on for however long it goes on. It says, the Gemara says, and there was an old man there, learned in Greek wisdom, who said to them in Greek, "You morons." That's Greek. "Don't you know that as long as you do that, you'll never win?" So they said, "What should we do?" So he said, "Well, tomorrow, when they lower the basket, put a pig in it." So sure enough, that's what they do. And the Gemara says that the pig, when it gets halfway up the walls of Jerusalem, it sticks its hooves into the walls, and the whole land of Israel shakes 400 parsa. And on that day, the rabbis declared, "Aguar ish, cursed be the one who raises pigs in the land of Israel, and cursed be the one who teaches their son Greek wisdom." Now, what is Greek wisdom? I mean, by the way, history, as I've told you guys many times, it's classic Greek wisdom. There is no word in Hebrew for history. It's historia. Herodotus is the originator of this notion. What is Greek wisdom? Greek wisdom is exactly what you just saw. It's dat chitzoni. What does he say to them? Get out of your story. You think that like what matters is serving your God by two goats on the altar? You want to win this battle? I'll tell you how to win the battle. Step outside your story. And indeed, they win. Of course, who comes next in that story? Rome, who is the pig in the rabbinic mind, right? So the question is Zuntz doing the same thing? And Zuntz, all these reformers, are they doing the same thing? Listen, we got to step out of our story, critical historical analysis and philology, and right, in order to sweep away the old and let in the new. A couple of people have brought up the fact that you can look down the line and make judgments on that from history. But that's not actually, if you look at what Zuntz writes, what he was looking to do, because I happen to be a big believer in coming to historical consciousness. And I think it's actually the great challenge that we face as a people today, particularly the more wedded you are to the Torah in our world, the less likely it is you have a historical consciousness, which in my eyes is not just sad, it's tragic and downright dangerous. Because real historical consciousness is the re-engagement at depth. Because that stepping out is a potential two-step motion. You step out to gain a critical perspective, not just on the development of Am Yisrael as a people, but onto the context into which we're developing. Because, of course, we're not just a people that exists alone in the world. There's a will of God everywhere, says the Baal Shem Tov. Malo kol ha'aretz kvodo. The whole world is filled with his will. And so, therefore, stepping back into the story is the recognition that there is a broader dimension into which our history is unfolding and might actually help us understand how not to just survive, but to thrive in a constantly changing world. And so we're at the end of a very small section of modernity, and it is an open question at this point in Jewish history, though, by the way, I think it's an open point in 2019, just as much as it's an open question back here in 1819, what is the way forward for Am Yisrael? But one thing I can promise you is this, is that once you open the box of historical consciousness, there's no going back, right? You can never be a traditional Jew again. You might choose to be a traditionalist, and there's a lot of power and promise in that. And you might choose to be a reformer with the power and promise that offers as well. But either way, history cannot be avoided. So I thank you guys for your attention and your patience. I apologize if that felt a little bit truncated, but you know what? Time waits for no one. I just encourage you guys to come back next year, and we'll go back to early modernity. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To download digital content, please visit elmod.pardes.org.